Did U.S. state and legal authorities deliberately frame Mumia Abu-Jamal for the murder of a white police officer in 1981? Is the state now trying to murder him through medical neglect of his hepatitis C condition? What threat does he pose to those authorities? Is the repression of Mumia symptomatic of a larger apparatus seeking to criminalize African Americans? On this week's Global Research NewsHour, on the same week when Americans are commemorating the anniversary of Martin Luther King's birth, we look at a modern revolutionary named Mumia Abu-Jamal, fearlessly speaking truth to power from behind prison walls and at a time when his life is threatened with an untreated illness. In this hour, we'll hear from longtime supporter Suzanne Ross about his background and about the current state of the Free Mumia campaign. And we'll hear from Glenn Ford, executive editor of Black Agenda Report, about where Mumia fits in the larger scheme of repression of black people in America. On this week's show, Free Mumia, Stop the Slow-Motion Assassination of a Modern Revolutionary. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of January 22nd, 2015. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Revelations that involve Hillary Clinton and her email scandal confirms what the real motives of the U.S. NATO-led war on Libya to remove Muammar Gaddafi, and it was not for democracy or to protect the Libyan people. There are several reasons why Western powers want Africa under their control besides their appetite for natural resources, and that is to keep Africa under their control. Washington and Paris want to remain a dominant power politically and economically with their currencies in place instead of Gaddafi's idea, which called for the gold dinar to replace U.S. dollars and euros. Africa is to remain a captive market under the West because it is their corporations and special interest groups who should profit. U.S. presidential candidate Hillary Clinton and her email prove that the Obama and Sarkozy administrations wanted Libya's oil, gold, and silver under their control with their puppets, or terrorists, in place after Gaddafi was removed from power. That comes from the article, Hillary Clinton's Emails Confirm the Real Agenda Behind the U.S.-NATO War on Libya, by Timothy Alexander Guzman, posted January 20th, originally appearing in Silent Crow News. The oil market is not the market of raw materials. Supply contracts for actual oil makes only 2% of the market. The rest, speculative securities, futures, and other derivatives. Prices for futures are not determined by supply and demand, but by expectations. The futures market is completely controlled by the largest U.S. banks. This is the market of expectations, which creates a real industry of expectations using the notorious rating agencies, independent experts, and the media. That comes from the article, Goldman Sachs Makes Oil Prices Drop, by Mikhail Leontiev, posted January 20th, originally appearing in the Russian language at 1TV Russia and on the Voltaire Network. Even as some of European youth's best and brightest have tried to fight the immense violence of neoliberalism via alter-globalization, the poorest among the young are now mired in violence and suicidal nihilism, extreme Wahhabism, which they've learned online. All across the spectrum, driven by fear, the toxic mix of political and economic instability continues to spread, leading quite a few insiders to wonder whether both the Fed and the Politburo Standing Committee in Beijing don't really know what's happening. And that once again feeds the warmongering hordes for which that good old-fashioned world war is the easiest ticket out. Cancel all the old debt, issue loads of new debt, turn plowshares and iPhones into cannons, and after a little thermonuclear exchange, welcome to full employment and a new wasteland of opportunity. That comes from the article Planet of Fear by Pepe Escobar, posted January 20th, originally appearing at Strategic Culture Foundation. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Mumia Abu-Jamal has spent more than half his life behind prison bars. In 1982, he was convicted on the charge of murder in the first degree over the shooting death of Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner. At the time of his arrest, Mumia Abu-Jamal was a supporter of the Revolutionary Move organization, a former member of the Black Panther Party, and a dissident radio journalist covering stories of police corruption and repression of people in the African-American community. He was president of the Philadelphia Association of Black Journalists. Unwilling to compromise his reporting, he did not work for any mainstream news organizations, preferring instead to work freelance and earn extra money by driving a taxicab. It is widely speculated that his fearless and uncompromising journalism and truth-telling was a little too inconvenient for certain entrenched interests, providing a motive to eliminate him. One fateful night in December of 1981, Mumia was driving his cab when he witnessed an altercation between his brother, William Cook, and a white police officer by the name of Daniel Faulkner. Mumia got out of his cab to investigate. When police arrived at the scene several minutes later, Faulkner was found dead with bullet wounds to the back and head. Mumia was sitting nearby with a bullet wound in the chest and a gun registered to him laying nearby. There were numerous irregularities in the legal process that followed, leading many close observers to conclude Mumia was unfairly prosecuted. For example, the impartiality of the judge, Albert F. Sabo, has been brought into serious question given his history of extensive involvement with police and law enforcement, which would conceivably affect his judgment in the case of the murder of a cop. A 1983 survey of members of the Philadelphia legal community found that as many as one-third of responding attorneys found him unqualified to be on the bench. Mumia was denied the right to legal counsel of his choice. Court-appointed attorney Anthony Jackson was imposed on him. Mumia's requests to be represented by John Africa were repeatedly denied by Sabo. Further, the defense was not allowed sufficient funds to employ an investigator, ballistics expert, or pathologist who could help shed some light on the facts around the case. The prosecution used 11 of its 15 peremptory strikes to remove African Americans from the jury, leaving only two black jurors on a jury of 16, that including alternate jurors. Out of proportion with the general population that was 40% African American. The case against Mumia rested on three pillars: a supposed confession he made when he was brought into the hospital that evening, eyewitnesses claiming to have seen him commit the crime, and the presence of Mumia's gun at the scene, alleged to have been the murder weapon. Three individuals, two police officers and a hospital security guard, claimed to have heard Mumia confess to the crime. He supposedly shouted it, even though doctors at the hospital claimed from the time he arrived that he was weak, on the verge of fainting. What's more, the alleged confession was not mentioned to investigators until February of 82, fully 2 months after the incident. Two of these witnesses claimed, implausibly, that they did not think the outburst was significant enough to report to police. One of the eyewitnesses, a prostitute named Cynthia White, claimed to have seen Mumia run up to Faulkner, shoot him in the back, and then fire a shot at his head while the wounded officer lay on the ground. There are indications that she had been enticed to offer an account favorable to the prosecution. A second prostitute, Veronica Jones, stated that she had likewise been given incentives to implicate Mumia in the killing but refused to cooperate. Judge Sabo had removed the jury during her deposition, so they were left unaware of the police offering inducements to these witnesses. Then there was the ballistics evidence. Police failed to test Mumia's gun properly to ascertain whether this was in fact the murder weapon. Medical records revealed that the bullet which penetrated Mumia's body was on a downward trajectory, not upwards, which is what one would expect if the bullet was fired from Faulkner while he lay on the ground, according to the prosecution's theory. The jury delivered a guilty verdict after 3 hours of deliberations and subsequently sentenced Mumia to death. The case was appealed to the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania in March of 1989 and denied. In 2001, a federal court judge ordered Mumia's death sentence be overturned. However, it would be another 11 years before Mumia would be released from death row. He remains in detention at the State Correctional Institute, Mahanoy, in Frackville, Pennsylvania, serving a sentence of life without parole. The latest chapter in the Mumia Abu-Jamal saga revolves around his suffering from the symptoms of hepatitis C, which is wreaking havoc on his body and causing him sleeplessness and pain. The Department of Corrections is apparently denying him the treatment which could save his life. Over the last 30 years, Mumia Abu-Jamal has become an international icon, with activist organizations springing up to demand his release. Mumia has released 8 books while in captivity, including Live from Death Row, Harper Perennial, and The Classroom in the Cell, Conversations on Black Life in America from Third World Press. He has written numerous articles and has released frequent radio essays, podcast at the site prisonradio.org. He's also the subject of the 2013 documentary, Long Distance Revolutionary. Glenn Ford will join us later in the hour to provide some important political and historic context to the Mumia Abu-Jamal story. But first, we get an interview from a longtime advocate. We're joined right now by Suzanne Ross. She's a clinical psychologist and international representative of International Concerned Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal. She's also active with the Free Mumia Abu-Jamal Coalition and has been a longtime anti-imperialist activist. She joins us from New York City. How are you today, Suzanne?
Good morning. Good morning.
I was wanting to get a bit of a short summary of Mumia's situation. I know you could probably go on for hours about what you see as the miscarriage of justice in his case, but I'm wondering if you could just explain why, as you see it, the original arrest and charge for the murder of White Officer Daniel Faulkner does represent, in fact, a miscarriage of justice. I mean, maybe the two or three key bullet points.
Okay, well, let's put in the context, first of all, that Mumia had been an activist since he was quite young, 14, 15, and had been followed by the FBI. The FBI records on him date back to when he was 14 years old, when he was beaten up for speaking out against George Wallace, believe it or not. So they were following him early, and he was he helped form the Black Panther Party chapter in Philadelphia. Soon became the communications director at age 16 or something like that, and again called more and more attention to himself by being so outspoken in Philadelphia. He ultimately became a journalist, and as a journalist, spoke, had a show on a black station, and people would run home to listen to this show because he was the voice of the voiceless. He became named the voice of the voiceless at that time because he spoke about all the racism and disenfranchisement of the poor and the outrageous repression of the Rizzo regime and so on that was happening at the time. So, for people who know about the COINTELPRO operations, counterintelligence operations that J. Edgar Hoover began, it was not surprising that they would eventually get him, just as they killed so many people, starting, you know, not starting with, but notably Fred Hampton Jr. and so many young, gifted activists in the Black Panther Party who were killed or jailed or whatever. It was not surprising that someone as gifted as Mumia and as well known at a young age as him would be targeted. And so that's how the story starts. He shows up. He's at a street. I don't know if you want the details of how he got arrested and so on, but he got arrested on very questionable circumstances where he was running to go help his brother who was being beaten by the police. He saw his brother, ran over there, and before he knew it, literally before he knew it, he was beaten so badly that he was rushed to the hospital and nearly died, and charged with the killing of the officer, even though someone else had been at the scene of the shooting who was much, much more likely. Mumia had no arrests prior to that date and no charges or anything like that, and was known to be a nonviolent peacemaker. So being in that context and with a very, very corrupt group of police officers who were quickly assigned to that scene, 15 of whom were later indicted for other things, for corruption and so on, and a particular person who, a particular officer who was clearly involved in a conspiracy to get Mumia and other radicals. I mean, this is an era where the targeting of Black radicals was considered a key strategy. We learn more and more about that. So the conspiracy goes on. Mumia's case is assigned. He's denied the opportunity to get his own attorney, denied the opportunity to speak in the trial. All kinds of things happen to him, and the judge who's assigned to the case is a notorious racist, old, came out of retirement to handle this case, and known to be a close friend of the Fraternal Order of Police for decades. And this is the judge who takes over the case. And in the process of the trial, even the mainstream press in Philadelphia began saying, we got to get rid of this judge. It's too much of an embarrassment. You know, the guy is guilty. People, you know, they all assumed Mumia was guilty. But let's get a decent judge that doesn't make it look so bad. Well, if they hadn't had... If they had had a decent judge, Mumia would never have been convicted, you know?
Some significant legal point. Yeah.
That in order for him to be convicted, they needed a corrupt, racist judge who was willing to break all the rules and who was overheard to say during the trial in a courtroom next door to his own, I'm going to help them fry that nigger. And that's a quote. I'm going to help them fry that nigger. And he had, excuse my use of the word, and he, a very, very respectable type court stenographer, testified that she overheard him say this.
Okay.
So that's just the beginning of, as you said, I could go on for years, but that's how it started. Mumia gets convicted. He gets sentenced to death. Even if you thought he was guilty and the trial was fair, the judges in the federal court who reviewed the case, you know, after it was finished in state court, ruled, Judge Yan in particular, ruled that the assignment of the death penalty to someone, and he supported the idea that Mumia was guilty, but he said that he never should have been given the death penalty because they didn't get a chance to even present mitigating arguments, you know, of the fact that Mumia had never had an arrest record, that he was revered, really, in the community, was seen as a peacemaker, all kinds of people willing to testify for him, et cetera, et cetera. And in 2000, this judge ruled that Mumia should not be on death row and should be removed for death row and sentenced to life in prison. It took 11 years for them to take him off death row. 11 years after the judge ruled this, because the city of Philadelphia appealed it and kept wanting to insist that the death penalty should continue. When they finally took him off death row, they decided not to appeal it anymore. I guess it looked pretty bad for them. And all the evidence was that this was an outrageous ruling. I mean, not only was it outrageous that Mumia was found guilty, but even more outrageous that he was sentenced to death. So he was removed from death row, which was a victory of ours, meaning that's not what we wanted. We wanted his release, but it was a victory in the sense that we forced them to get him off death row. And for years, that had been one of the major demands, of course, a key demand. No executions, stop the death penalty, et cetera, et cetera. And internationally, there had been outrage.
So it was basically, you're saying it was the political pressure more than just the wheels of the legal system that eventually got him free from death row?
Unquestionably so. Okay. Unquestionably, because as you see, the political wheels took 11 years mm-hmm. to get him off death row when they themselves had ruled that he should never have been on death row. It took 11 years to get him off that. I mean, think of how shocking that is. Keeping this person in total isolation, not being able to touch anybody, his, you know, his wife, his children, his grandchildren, not being able to leave his cell without shackles on him, not being able to see anyone without in a contact visit. In other words, I visited him during that time, and, you know, there was always a plexiglass between us. And being treated as this continuous horror monster, cop killer, how they called him all the time, even though Judge Yon had ruled that he should be off death row. And eventually he was removed based on that original ruling, but 11 years later. Talk about the wheels of justice working slowly. We should say the wheels of injustice work quickly, meaning they keep the oppression going forever if they can. And we did have major campaigns internationally all over the world. Streets were named after Mumia. Medals and honors were given to him. In fact, we're just going back to Paris, to a little suburb of Paris called Saint-Denis, where 10 years ago, in April 2006, a street was named after Mumia and Saint-Denis, and we're going back to celebrate the 10th year anniversary. And the police in Philadelphia went crazy about it at the time and demanded that the name be removed and that an apology be given to the police and so on and so on. And the people of Saint-Denis were very courageous and insisted on their right to honor Mumia. And so we're going back this April to celebrate that. So this has been a struggle with many, many facets of the people's voice versus the state, the repressive apparatus of the United States government and all the forces behind them that have really, and I use this word scientifically, not rhetorically, have really conspired to kill Mumia.
So December 2011, district attorney Seth Williams announced that they would no longer seek the death penalty for Mumia Abu-Jamal, and then the next month was released into the general prison population. So I was just wondering, like, that period from the time that he was released into the general population to 2015, what kind of treatment was he receiving? What kind of reception from prison authorities? Is there anything particularly unusual about it, or was it pretty
standard? Well, thank you, first of all, for summarizing again the role, you know, how that happened, the 2011 ruling, and Seth Williams so despondently announced that he wasn't going to be able to seek the death penalty any longer. But even at that moment, I mean, there hasn't been a moment when we haven't had to fight. So at that moment, when he was taken out of SCI, State Correctional Institution at SCI Green, where in Waynesboro, where he had been for many, many years on death row, he was transferred to SCI Mahanoy in Fraxville. Isn't that ironic, that word, for people in Canada in particular who've struggled about the environmental issues, that these towns are named with such names is definitely not by chance. At any rate, he is now transferred in 2011, at the end of 2011, to Mahanoy, and they put him in isolation where, you know, for people who are not on death row, but people who violated infractions or who are considered dangerous for one reason or another. And they put him in this oppressive situation where he could only have visitors now for 1 hour, no phone calls, and the most horrific conditions, seemingly as punishment for having won the right to not be executed. So we waged a fight then. We went up to the... Mumia said, put me back on death row at one point. He said, rather than this. I mean, he said the conditions were horrendous. So we waged a fight, and we went to the head of the Department of Corrections, the headquarters of Department of Corrections, and basically did a little sit-in. At that point, I was also dealing with Juan Mendez, who's the Special Commissioner on Torture of the United Nations, Human Rights Commission, who had issued that wonderful statement, heroic statement about being in isolation for more than 2 weeks should be considered torture. Back about 5 years ago, he issued that statement, which had huge reverberations. So we had gone to see him and asked him to convene. So we came to SCI, and we came to the headquarters of Department of Corrections and said, look, we're getting in touch now with Juan Mendez. We're demanding investigation by the United Nations. We're not going to leave until you release him, blah, 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 blah. And there were about 20 of us, I think, at the time. We did this kind of on the spur of the moment, really. And we were told, Mumia had been told that day that unless he signed papers saying that saying that he would not hold the prison authorities responsible in any way if something happened to him in the prison once he was released into general population, you know, that he would never be released if he didn't sign that. Now, that's basically an invitation or collaboration with allowing them to kill him because, you know, they set up people to be killed. And when they say, we want you to sign papers saying we're not responsible, Mumia is not, to say the least, is not stupid about the system.
I was thinking the same thing. Who, excuse my language, the hell would sign something like that?
Exactly, exactly. So that was what they asked him at the end of December 2011, that's what they were asking him to do, and he said, no way, of course. When we came to the prison, we knew that. I mean, to the DOC, to the Department of Corrections, when we did this little sit-in at the Department of Corrections, we knew that they were threatening Mumia with that. Guess what? We told them we would be back again and again and again, and that we were going to get this to the United Nations. The next morning, they show up in his cell, release him, and ask him nothing about signing. Nothing about signing. And he was released into general population at that point with, you know, the ordinary conditions of general population. And it is a tribute to our movement. The Mumia movement has been extraordinary in its consistency, in its internationalism, in its creativity and so many other things about it, that we were able to get Mumia released despite that threat that he would never get out if he didn't sign that paper, and he got out the next morning without signing anything.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
I know that you'd put out the statement that... that the Department of Corrections should be held accountable not only for medical malpractice, but medical malfeasance.
Right.
And I'm wondering if you could explain what you meant by that.
Well, first of all, he was in the infirmary for a few, I can't remember how long, in the month of February. And he documented what they did with him during that month. Well, one of the things they did is they did blood tests. The blood tests clearly showed two things. One, that he had, which they already knew when he was transferred out of death row into general population, they did blood tests and found that he had hepatitis C. That's the first Mumia knew of it. So he first found out in 2011 that he had hepatitis C. But they didn't do any tests on it. They didn't investigate it. They didn't recommend anything to him about how he should deal with it. Lo and behold, he ends up with a skin problem starting in 2014, the summer of 2014. He thinks it's just itching. He minimizes it. By January and February of 2015, he's getting sicker and sicker. He goes to the infirmary. They start, quotes, treating him. Well, one, they don't deal with the hepatitis C, which they now, you know, they know he has. And two, they don't tell him that his blood sugar is elevated, dangerously elevated. He knows nothing about that. To make a long story short, in that period, and everything is, of course, a long story, on March 30th of last year, Mumia passes out and goes into a diabetic shock, rushed to the hospital. They find that his sugar level is so high that he could have easily died, and that probably the treatment they gave him, I mean, this is the hypothesis, but, you know, we're still not sure, the treatment they gave him for his skin, which included steroids, may have set off this episode of intense diabetes. He had never had diabetes before. And also, now, with the additional information that some doctor who's come onto the case, who's very, very good, has diagnosed that this is probably a case of, that the hepatitis C could have contributed to the creation of the development of the diabetes. So whatever it is, they gave him diabetes.
Okay.
He had never had it before. And he's rushed to the hospital. They keep him there for one day, two nights, bring him back to the prison, offer him nothing. You know, he gets pasta for dinner and some kind of cake, dessert, and, you know, I mean, totally not dealing with his diet and totally not taking seriously that his life had just been endangered. Of course, he gets sick again. He's then rushed to the hospital again. And I think it was the beginning of May by that time, early May, he's rushed to a different hospital, much better hospital, where they do extensive tests and keep him there for a little over a week and recommend that his hepatitis C be further assessed. His diabetes eventually disappears. We don't know what that means, you know, if it's gone forever or just ameliorate, whatever, you know, but he's not sick from diabetes anymore because he's not given the steroids. And he is returned to the infirmary at SCI Mahanoy, where he continues to be right now. And in the process, they never diagnosed what he had. You know, prison doctors at the prison, the infirmary doctors, and all the consultants they brought in, and you should hear we heard them in court. They sound like these these consultants. I tell you, I'm a child of Nazi Europe, and I was raised on the whole idea of doctors being torturers and doctors collaborating with the government and with the enemy and repressive forces. I mean, I know the stories, and I couldn't help but think of that as I'm listening to these horrendous doctors in the courtroom. That was just in December when we were in court in Scranton. I'm jumping ahead at this point. At any rate, Mumia's lawyers then file for demanding treatment because the doctor who has seen him only in the visiting room, he's not allowed to see Mumia to treat him as a patient because they're not recognizing him as a doctor. They just recognize their own doctors. But he's a very smart black doctor who spent time in around the world, worked with Doctors Without Borders, and is experienced both in HIV and hepatitis C, and looked at Mumia and said, he's suffering from the symptoms of hepatitis C, and that's what the skin problem is about, and that's why he's so sick. And he needs to get the new miracle drug which has worked on hepatitis C, cures people, literally cures people.
And it's been endorsed by several high, you know, very prominent associations, including the World Health Organization, the Infectious Disease Society of America, and other, I guess, you know, medical authorities outside of the consultants that this DOC is contracting.
Exactly. They're the only ones who are not recognizing this treatment. But ironically, I mean, this is a, as a matter of fact, I just finished taking it because I got a hepatitis C through a blood transfusion that I didn't even know about 30 years ago. And once this medicine became available, I decided to take it, and I immediately got cured. So it's known to be very, very effective, and with minimal side effects that people know about so far, at least. And the doctor urged that Mumia get it immediately because his symptoms were so serious. It wasn't just hepatitis C. Like, I never had any symptoms like Mumia had. Mumia is black. The some of the symptoms that he's exhibiting are unique or overwhelmingly prevalent among black people who have hepatitis C. And this is what this doctor came up with, all these, this wonderful analysis of what's happening and why Mumia is showing these symptoms. And to contrast him with the doctors that the prison showed as in the courtroom a couple of weeks ago when we were there as part of the challenge to the Department of Corrections to get Mumia this treatment. And so we had witnesses, you know, the doctors in the who saw Mumia in the infirmary or who consulted about him. Some of them didn't even see him. Give their interpretation of why he shouldn't get it, and ultimately he shouldn't get it because he's a prisoner. And they, one of them, didn't know anything about the drug. It seemed to not know anything about hepatitis C. The skin doctor who was the specialist, and then the guy who was head of the whole Department of Corrections medical facility, his name is Dr. Cowan, he acknowledged on very clever questioning by Mumia's attorney, Bob Boyle, he acknowledged that if somebody came to him in private practice and had the insurance to cover this very, very expensive medication, which is another outrage, what the pharmaceutical companies do with this, that he would recommend this drug. But in Mumia's case, he doesn't recommend it.
So
a double standard of treatment for those who are lucky not to be in prison and happen to have the insurance for it, and versus those who happen to be in prison and treated as though their lives don't matter at all, and given the kind of treatment that Mumia's gotten. And Mumia has gotten better treatment for sure than the thousands of other people in prison because there's a movement behind him. So we demand all the time the same care for Mumia, for the other prisoners to get the same care. Those who have hepatitis C, our campaign is focused heavily on all the prisoners. And that's where we're at the point. At this point, you know, we've had this hearing. We've had these hearings in court. They were very impressive. Our side was very impressive. Our lawyers, our doctor.
So this lawsuit isn't just for Mumia. It's essentially for everybody who's behind bars, who's being denied, who's subjected to this kind of double standard of treatment.
Well,
when
the,
it comes to Hep C,
the particular case that the lawyers, they lawyers can't simply represent thousands of prisoners.
But there's implications, right?
Implications of that. And our campaign focuses on the thousands of prisoners. And there are other suits that have been brought in Pennsylvania against the Department of Corrections. And in the process of this campaign, one of the wonderful things was that we and some of the black legislators demanded that the Department of Corrections show us their protocol for how they treat hepatitis C. Well, they said they had no protocol. So we said, so get one, you know, write one up. So in the courtroom, we finally got the new guidelines. They finally came up. They had to come up with a protocol. They have somewhere between 7 and 12,000 people with hepatitis C in the prison. And so they couldn't say they're not going to have a protocol. They came up with a protocol that is obscene because it lists about 500 conditions. I may be exaggerating. all kinds of conditions under which people should not get this medicine. And the whole focus is on who should not get the treatment. So anyone who has ever rejected treatment before, anyone who's ever used drugs, anyone who is not really, I mean, the condition of getting the medicine is that you have to be so sick that you have internal bleeding caused in the esophagus. And, of course, not surprisingly, only six people have gotten the medicine in all of Pennsylvania's prisons. So when you read that document, you go, oh, my God, talk of genocide. I mean, they're willing to casually talk of denying people basic medical care that as you mentioned earlier, all these mainstream organizations, I say, treat it as quickly as you can. The longer you wait, the worse the prognosis. Treat it as quickly as you can under all circumstances. In other words, everybody who has it. You know, you don't have to be dying. You don't have to be have a huge, a viral load. That's one of the things that you measure in hepatitis C, viral load. The prison says, well, if your viral load isn't very high, you don't have... Well, all the doctors and everybody says the viral load has very little to do with how sick you are, whether you should be eligible for this treatment. So that's where we're at now. We're waiting to hear from the court. The 3 days were quite remarkable. I would say the movement showed itself to be very impressive in its ethics, in its competence. And the state of Pennsylvania showed itself to be totally reprehensible, both in its ethics, lack of ethics, and its incompetence.
In our interview, Suzanne Ross stressed the importance of bringing international pressure to bear on the governor of Pennsylvania to assist Mumia.
I think that's an important thing that people can do because the governor is not the worst. He actually signed a moratorium on the death penalty. Pennsylvania is one of the states in the United States that still has the death penalty. And as soon as he came into office, as he had promised, he shockingly signed this moratorium in the face of the Fraternal Order of Police and the Republican Party and many other people being opposed to it. So he has some courage, some principles, and contacting him is not just an exercise. I don't believe it's just an exercise in futility. And the fact that we had a letter circulated that Archbishop Tutu and Minister Farrakhan and Cornel West and all kinds of people signed this letter addressed to the governor back in, I believe that was in April, means that continuing to focus on him, I think, is strategic. And from around the world to get those messages from around the world, I think is important.
Okay, well, Suzanne Ross, I think we'll have to leave it there, but I want to thank you very much for sharing this this important story and these important updates with our listening audience, and I wish you all the best as the campaign moves forward.
And what a pleasure it's been to talk with you and find you so knowledgeable and supportive, and I hope you continue on this station and continue to do the work you do.
All the best.
Bye-bye.
We've been speaking with Suzanne Ross, International Representative of International Concerned Family and Friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal and active with the Free Mumia Abu-Jamal Coalition, also a longtime anti-imperialist activist. Joining us now from Plainsfield, New Jersey, is Glenn Ford. He is the executive editor for Black Agenda Report, an online resource providing news and analysis from the black left. Glenn Ford, welcome to our program.
Thanks for the invitation.
I'm wondering if I could get from you your assessment as to why Mumia was targeted.
If you're speaking of why the Philadelphia police focused on Mumia, And outside of the larger context of why black males and the black community in general have been targeted for a particular brand of oppression by the U.S. government, well, Mumia was a radio reporter. He worked for a number of radio stations. He was well known to the police, even aside and apart from the high-profile role that he played in the police conflict with the MOVE organization in Philadelphia. So the cops knew who Mumia Abu-Jamal was. He was the reporter who would not take as gospel the police version of events, and in fact would bring not a prejudice, but a wisdom of the oppressed to a news story about conflicts between the people and the police. So he was not a question mark. He was not just another brother to be beat down in the street and framed, although that's quite enough of an excuse for a cop in any American city. He was a target because they knew him and they knew his work.
Okay. Now, we are having this conversation just 4 days after Martin Luther King Day, when another very, charismatic and outspoken leader was being honored. Both King and Mumia appear to have been threats to that establishment. Did you see any significant differences in emphasis in terms of the way both these men have been targeted?
We have to look at not just Dr. King and Mumia, but all black folks who are political, who are in opposition to the prevailing order, as coming under the same category as far as the state is concerned. That is, every large police department, whether it admits it or not, has a bureau that specializes in dissidents, and that bureau usually is specializes in dissidents who come from the black community or some other minority community. This is part of American policing. That is, on the macro level, we have a system of mass black incarceration that stigmatizes and targets all black folks as criminals or potential criminals who are in need of containment. So the subcategory of folks in that larger group are those who might organize the larger black group for resistance, and those are the leaders. The police don't parse the difference between a King's democratic socialism and a black a Black Panthers revolutionary nationalism. What they are concerned about is whether the people who are targeted are able to unite the larger group of black folks whose job it is for the police to contain.
Now, in your speeches and your writing, and I think what you've been talking about is the sentiment that since the late 1960s, right up into today under President Barack Obama, the U.S. government has been engaged in a counterinsurgency against the black population. And I'm wondering what it was about the 1960s that may have triggered that response.
Well, of course, as everyone knows, hundreds of cities went up in flames in the 1960s, and especially, of course, in 1968 in April after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King. But just as importantly, inseparable from that, is the fact that black folks, not just the Panther Party, but many other organizations who are forgotten now because they were stamped out during that general repression of 69 and 70 and during that period, that it is black folks who were developing an ideology of resistance that was radically socialist, also sometimes called African socialist, but radically socialist, absolutely anti-imperialist, and far more uncompromising than anything that the United States had seen that had taken root among masses of young people up to that time. They really were afraid of revolutionary black nationalism, of black politicization of any kind. And that's why J. Edgar Hoover said that the Black Panther Party was the greatest danger to national security domestically of the United States. But he also said that Dr. Martin Luther King was the most dangerous single personality in the United States. That's why I pointed out that it really doesn't matter to these people whether you're talking about a revolutionary nationalist organization like the Panther Party or a Nobel Peace Prize winner like Dr. King. Both of them were anti-imperialist. Both of them were uncompromising in terms of the principles of the state being subordinate to the people rather than the other way around. Both were seen as class one dangers to the stability of the American order at that time. And of course, all of this with the background of constant warfare between blacks and whites in the United States, if you consider that slavery was a warfare, and that the suppression of Reconstruction was warfare, and that the imposition of Jim Crow terror, either by the Klan or Jim Crow police against black folks for 100 years after the Civil War, was terror. In that kind of situation, counterinsurgency, that is the suppression of those who are resisting being repressed, is a normal state of affairs in the United States, one that was just ramped up dramatically at the end of the 1960s.
We hear about the military-industrial complex, and of course there's this prison-industrial complex with mass incarceration, which generates profits for certain individuals, raises stock values, creates jobs, and so on. So I'm wondering if you might be able to comment on the economics incentives of this counterinsurgency that you speak of it maintaining that violent status quo, if not instigating it, and how the economics of the counterinsurgency might undermine revolutionary activity.
Yeah, I'm not one of those who believes that the profitability of the prison industrial complex is the primary reason that it continues to survive and thrive. I think that the security of the state and the capitalist system that the state protects is the most important reason for mass black incarceration and all of the attendant crimes that go with mass black incarceration. But the profitability of the system is important to different sectors. It's important if you're upstate, that is in New York, upstate is where the prisons are, or if you're in Illinois, downstate, where the prisons are, because those become bulwarks of the local economy in those overwhelmingly white areas, which are disproportionately represented in state legislatures and therefore have outside political weight. Also, prison guards are mostly unionized, and so they are a Trojan horse in the labor movement. You know, one of our supposedly most progressive unions asked me, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, although it is politically progressive on most issues, the entire organization is held back by the presence of these hundreds of thousands of prison guards, most of whom belong to AFSCME. And they, of course, agitate for an intensification of mass black incarceration because that makes their jobs more secure and gives them more bargaining power. So they're a curse and cancer on the labor movement. And now, of course, there are a number of prison corporations that sell stock on the U.S. Stock Exchange. They have to notify their potential investors that the potential profits of the company are subject to the political winds that might affect the rate of mass incarceration. Empty beds in prison mean lower profits for stockholders. So there is an embedded investment cadre out there who have a vested direct interest every quarter in the maintenance and spread of mass incarceration. But again, the primary reason for the United States being the mass incarceration state in the world is because of the perceived and real threat that an aroused and organized black population represents to the political order here.
Now, one more quick question. In addition to the question of this mass incarceration, the detention of Mumia, we've also seen the tragedies of the killings of Trayvon Martin and Tamir Rice and on, and it's given birth to the Black Lives Matter and similar solidarity movements. And I'm wondering if you have any concerns about groups which raise awareness about these injustices, but don't place it in that context of a counterinsurgency.
Yeah, if it's not understood in its historical context, then it becomes inevitable that those who agitate and work up the people and get people looking forward to a struggle for real solutions to the crisis. It becomes inevitable that they focus on proceduralisms and petty reforms. So it becomes the lack of a larger vision as to why the police treat us like they do, what the police mission is rather than the kind of clothes they wear or the caliber of weapons that they carry. Ultimately means that you'll have a short-lived and very frustrated movement. But all the indications are that there are enough folks with a healthy historical vision involved in the current incipient movement that we won't get bogged down in those proceduralisms. The biggest danger to this movement is getting entangled with the Democratic Party, which in Black America is hegemonic in its presence. It's in all of the political churches. It infests all of our fraternities and sororities, in addition, of course, to being the party of virtually all Black elected and appointed officials. So the Democratic Party is the great impediment to any effective revolutionary organization in the Black community, because it's everywhere.
Well, Glenn Ford, I think I speak for our greater listenership when I say we really appreciate the refreshing perspectives that you provided for us today. Thank you for joining us, and I hope we can speak again.
Yes, just give me a call.
And we've been speaking with Glenn Ford, executive editor for Black Agenda Report. His articles and commentaries appear on the website blackagendareport.com. Many of his essays also appear at globalresearch.ca. One final note. If you are in the New York City area this Monday, January 25th, there will be a report back on Mumia's condition and the current state of the legal proceedings to get the treatment he needs and plans moving forward. That takes place at the historic Riverside Church at 91 Claremont Avenue in room 9T. This event is free and open to the public. For more details about Mumia's plight and how to help, please visit www.freemumia.com. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.